Kabbalah. That's the laws of nature, and Hashgacha Prat is not personal intervention in the laws of nature. Is that correct? That's the question. Okay. The reason why God made the laws of nature is so that people should take responsibility for their lives. In other words, today, if I have a child, I have to be very careful if I leave him or her near a pool, right? Because they'll fall in the pool and drown. But if there was only Hashgacha Pratis, it was only per God's personal intervention, I could take the child and throw him into the pool and nothing will happen because the child didn't do anything wrong. You see? So the thing is that I have to take certain responsibilities that I have if under the laws of nature that I wouldn't have if it was God's personal supervision. Now the reason why God gave the personal supervision, in other words, that the personal supervision, in other words, the laws of nature are based on certain laws, as we know, it's not moral, it's not ethical. In other words, smoking is not a moral or ethical problem. Smoking is a health problem, okay? It's a health problem. It has nothing to do with morals or ethics. However, God's personal supervision, that's based on good and evil. In other words, if Klal Yisrael keeps the Torah, so then everything good will happen, right? In other words, like this. According to the laws of nature, things grow for a certain amount of time. You have a certain amount of good years, then you have a bad year or two, and sometimes you have a few bad years, and then good years come. It's just a chancy thing based on the system of laws of nature. If Klal Yisrael keeps Torah, you see, so then for 80 years straight, we'll have good weather. We'll have perfect weather for planting, for growing. And we can have 7 years straight bad if we don't keep Torah. Or we can have total famine. For how many years we do not repent or do tshuva? Okay? So therefore, God's personal supervision over the world is based on good and evil. And God created it in such a way that an intelligent person can see and understand and they can't see the God's personal intervention in the world. There's a way of seeing it, that there is God's personal intervention, and so that you know that the world does have good and evil in it. So that's the difference between the laws of nature. Laws of nature were created so that you have responsibility, you take responsibility for your own life. God's personal supervision is to show the world that there is good and evil, that the world has some method of working based on good and evil. And therefore, that would show that there is a God that's based on good and evil. The question is, what's there between Hashgacha Pratis and, in other words, God's personal supervision and miracles? My understanding is that God's personal supervision means God changes the direction of an object. In other words, if a comet is supposed to come down in a particular city and then to destroy the city, and then the city does tshuva, so God redirects the comet to go someplace else. Okay? That's Hashgacha Pratis. But however, a miracle or an ace, God suspends the laws of nature. In other words, water becomes a solid. You see? Water is not a solid. He makes it into a solid. So therefore, that's changing or suspending the laws of nature. It's better to use the word suspension because he's not changing. It's only suspended for a short period of time, and then it comes back to the original way of operating. You have to understand both of them are against the laws of nature, but they're against the laws of nature in different ways. One is redirecting an object, and one is suspending its nature for a short period of time. Right, the question is like this. We have different generations of rabbis. One was like called the generation of the Tanoim, Then afterwards came the Amoraim. The Tanoim, if they made a statement, the Amoraim could not argue on them. Okay? So the question is, was the Tanoim wise? There could be, but that is not why the Amoraim could not argue with them. To explain that, we have to go back to Moshe Rabbeinu gave the Torah to all of Israel, and he gave the oral law. The oral law means that every detail, every single fact that you need to run the system of Torah was given. There was nothing left out. Every fact was given. God gave every fact to Moshe, and there was no two possibilities. There was only one halacha, and that was it. And the question is, if the whole Torah was taught to the Jews, was taught to the nation, so then how come they had problems and they had to come to Moshe for different questions? The answer is when we make the laws that God gave, we abstracted certain principles. In other words, cases that could occur are infinite. That you can't give all the cases. But however, the ideas that you need to run a system are finite. When we gave the cases, every case that God gave was based on an idea. So they had all the principles and ideas of the Torah, but there were certain particulars that they didn't know how to make decisions on. So since they didn't know how to make decisions on, they had to come to somebody that would know how to interpret it and know which principle it falls under to apply to that particular case. There's a Gemara that says that after Moshe died and they mourned him for 30 days, there were a few thousand laws that were lost. By lost, it doesn't mean that they didn't know about it. They didn't know whether a watch was wearing or carrying. They knew you were not allowed to carry, but the definition of carrying was lost. That's what he said, when you have to make a decision on law, you must have the concept or definition. So the definition, the exact precise definition was lost. And Yeshua went to God, and he said to God, could you give me back the laws? He wanted the laws, just like he gave it to Moshe. He wanted the doubts when they had the two possibilities. He wanted God to give him the laws. And God said to Yeshua, Lo b'shamayimi, it's not in heaven. Once there was the transmission was given over to Moshe, then it's not in the hands of God to help you out anymore. Now man is responsible, the human being is responsible for running the system. Question is, how do you maintain the system? How do you maintain the system? The answer is that you have a Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of 71 judges. There became two logical possibilities. They brought it to the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin discussed the law, and after they got through discussing it, they voted on it. Whatever they voted on became law. It is possible the way they voted on it was different than what God said on Mount Sinai. That is possible. But, however, it was given over to the people to take on the responsibility of running the system. God was not going to run the system anymore. It was up to the people to run the system. Now, this system worked very well till the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, why? Because the Sanhedrin convened in the Beis HaMikdash. After the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, they did not have a Sanhedrin anymore. Okay? So therefore, let's say, for instance, there would come out a difference of opinion among the sages, so it remained two logical possibilities. We didn't have a Sanhedrin to vote one way or the other. Okay? Now, that went on for a certain amount of time, and the man by the name of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he was a leader of the time. He was a Tana. He was the last of the Tanaim. Not the last. He was a Tana, the generation of Tanaim. He felt that there were so many possibilities that the system would be lost. So he wrote down the system of oral law as it was at that time, and that was the Mishnah. That became the Mishnah. Okay? Now, once they had the Mishnah, so they closed it off, and you couldn't argue on them. You understand? They couldn't argue. The reason why they can't argue is because if you argued on them, then the system would keep breaking down, more and more possibilities. So what they started doing is analyzing. In other words, the Mishnah became like a postulate system that we must accept. And that's because that's the oral law as we had it at the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Then we can analyze the Mishnah, like we see that what the Gemara does, it analyzes the Mishnah. But however, there came out different arguments, different opinions on how to interpret the Mishnah. So again, after a few hundred years, they closed off the Gemara, and you couldn't argue with the Amorayim. Then came the generation of the Rishonim, and the Rishonim, at that point, the Rishonim started analyzing. They couldn't argue with the Mishnah or the Gemara, and they started analyzing. But there were many different opinions of how to analyze the Mishnah and the Gemara. So we closed off the Mishnah, and today is the time of Achronim, where we use the Rishonim, or early Achronim, to analyze the Torah and the oral law. So that's why one person sometimes cannot argue with another, to protect the system. Not that one was smarter than the other. It could be he was. But it was to protect the system that we closed it off. Make sure that the system doesn't disintegrate. All right, the question is, when there is a machlokas, right? Question is, can we investigate further and find an answer to the machlokas? We have to understand there is a difference. There's a difference between the sciences and halacha. Okay? In science, we're gaining new knowledge. So if we're in doubt about a certain piece of information, we could do experiments, or we could wait till the facts come out. In other words, we're getting more facts about the universe, and since we have more facts about the universe, so we could clarify certain things which we didn't know before. Okay? However, in Torah, since the whole Torah, the legal system of Torah, the halachic part of Torah, was given on Mount Sinai, so all the facts were given there. Any fact that is lost, we cannot get back. Because God said, Lo b'ashamayim hi, it is not in heaven. In other words, it's not for God to give over the facts of Torah. It's once he gave it over to Moshe, then the responsibility of maintaining it is in the hands of the humans. Now, if we don't have a Sanhedrin to vote on it, so then there becomes two logical possibilities. Okay, so you'll say, how do we paskin, right? How do we make a decision? The answer is that when we make a decision, we're not saying which one God said on Mount Sinai. We do not know. That fact is lost. The only thing is we have two logical possibilities, and therefore these two logical possibilities will always remain true. Two possibilities. Psak means I must act according to one of them. So therefore, the posek tells you, you must act according to this one and not that one. Okay? But he is not saying what he is not saying. He's not saying this is the one God said on Mount Sinai. That he's not saying. All right, the question is, the question that we're asking is, let's say, for instance, a person says Lashon Hara to somebody that doesn't know who the person is, or you do not mention names, okay? But you're speaking Lashon Hara about somebody, okay? Now, the thing is, so the question is, since you know the facts anyway, the other person doesn't know the facts, but however, they will never know the person that said it. and there's no way of them knowing. So then the question is that considered Lashon Hara because no information is getting out about the person you're speaking about? Okay, the answer is like this. If it is practical, like you're speaking to your psychiatrist, or you're speaking to a friend and you want to get ideas, clear ideas, and you need help in making a decision, then of course you should tell it over, and of course try to protect the person that you're speaking about, but just to get the ideas how to deal with the situation. But however, let's say you have a desire to tell over Lashon Hara, and the person will not be hurt. You're telling over Lashon Hara, there is no benefit, but however, the person that you're speaking about cannot be hurt because nobody knows who you're talking about. The question is, what about that situation? Would you be allowed to speak Lashon Hara? The answer is there are two harms that come from Lashon Hara. The one you're speaking to, the one you're speaking about, and yourself. There's really three. Three people are hurt. Okay? Now the harm to you is not dependent on whether whether the person you're speaking about is known or not. It's the reason why you speak Lashon Hara is because of the need to speak Lashon Hara. That need, when you carry out that need, but not dealing with the need itself, but just carrying it out, that is harmful to the speaker and also harmful to the listener. Now the question is, does it, if you don't mention the name, does it fulfill your need for talking Lashon Hara? I think it can in certain cases. It can. It can. In other words, there are different various ways of looking at it, but I think it comes down to two things. If it is practical to work out a situation practically in your mind, and you are not harming the person that you're talking about, then you're allowed, then I think you should be able to do it. But if it, just once again, in other words, there are two ways of deciding whether you should talk it out. The one is that I have a need to express myself, that, and the need is based on the what is wrong with Lashon Hara, then you should not do it. If the need is a practical need, it's not a psychological need, but it's a practical need, like I have to get it, let's say, like the example that you use, like if somebody says to a person that they're rude, and the person that they said it to wants to know if they're really rude, so they check it out with somebody else without mentioning names, and to understand what rudeness is, or how to deal with rudeness, or if they really are rude, if it's something, a problem that they have to deal with. So therefore, then it becomes a practical problem. As long as they don't say who said it to them, then they have the right to discuss it. Okay, in his introduction to Devarim, so the Ramban says that one of the purposes of the tachacha, of the admonishment, or the rebuke that he gave to Israel, was the purpose was to show God's rachamim, that God's rachamim is that even though they did things, terrible things against God, God still forgave them, and he still helped them in their actions, and he didn't give up hope on them. And he explains why. He says, because if God didn't do this, so he says that then people, if he didn't say this, the reason why Moshe was telling the people for this is because if a person felt that as soon as he sins, God, he is punished, they'll feel that, like in this case, they were going into Eretz Israel, they'll feel like they're never getting to Eretz Israel. Why? Because it's impossible for a human being not to sin. That's an impossibility. Okay? He must sin. So therefore, he must know that God forgives him, and he still can get into the land despite the fact that he sinned. Okay? And God could overlook, not overlook, God doesn't overlook, but that God will still, in other words, there's still a chance of tshuva, still a chance for repentance on your part. Okay? That's what the Ramban says. I'd like to give first of all, I'd like to give an everyday example of this thing. There is people, when practically every kid I know, when they start the beginning of a year of school, they're all enthusiastic, and they all feel that this year they're going to make it. Big time. But however, as the year progresses, certain people fall by the wayside, and they just can't do it. Okay? And the question is, why? So there's a certain feeling in the unconscious that once I fail, I don't have the right, let's put it this way, I don't have the right to fail. There's certain people that feel that they don't have the right to fail, and when they do fail, these people, it's hard for them to operate. Once they fail, they can't come back to operate anymore, and they can't operate anymore. You see, it's an unconscious thing. You see, what God is trying to do is remove that possibility by telling you the fact that, no, that you're human, and human beings can fail, and I understand, and God says, I understand that, and so therefore, I gave you something called tshuva, repentance, so that you can undo the sin and start again, and just continue from where you left off. Okay? Now, however, in the Ramban, where the Ramban is talking about is, God is telling you a fact so that people should not be discouraged, and even though they did something wrong, they should not give up hope, and they should continue on. But there are people that in the unconscious, even if you tell them the reality, sometimes their unconscious still operates, and they live as if that they don't have the right to make an error. Okay? In other words, there's many times there are two parts to the person. And there is the conscious view of life and the unconscious view of life. And sometimes when you do an act which is contrary to what you hold consciously, then you know that there is a different view than the unconscious. In other words, like the example that I gave, there are certain students, if you ask them, don't you know humans make mistakes and they just have to continue on? Any human being knows that, you see. But however, the person many times when he makes a mistake, he acts as if he doesn't have the right to make a mistake. And once he made a mistake, there is absolutely no hope of him ever straightening that mistake out. And then the only way he could do it is like the beginning of the year, start all over, you understand? But he can't continue operating in this situation and just straighten himself out. Okay? So I'm just giving this, from the Ramban, I'm trying to show you that there are, in every human being, there are two views of life. That which you think consciously and that which you think unconsciously is two different views. And which one you act by, you have to see. Sometimes you're acting based on your conscious view, and sometimes you're acting based on your unconscious view, and you have to be aware of both of them. You know, in other words, like this, you hold your conscious, you know, if you ask anybody, is there a human being that doesn't make a mistake? You will say, no, it's impossible. And everybody knows that fact. Okay? And everybody knows the fact that you make a mistake and then you should correct it and move on. Well, if you can't correct it, move on anyway, and that's it. But some people feel that once they make a mistake, there is no hope. Once they feel there is no hope, they can't operate. They can't operate anymore. That is my understanding of why many students come in enthused, not many, I don't know if it's many or a lot or a few, I don't know the statistics, but there are students that come in very enthused at the beginning of the year, then at a certain point they just can barely operate, they don't have the same drive, they can hardly operate. It's not because they don't want it. It's not because they don't want to study. They do want to study, but the fact is they feel it's hopeless. There's a sense that once I make a mistake, it is hopeless, and I can't do it. That is one possible reason. I'm not saying there aren't other possible reasons, but there's a certain sense of hopelessness that they have, and it's based on the premise that once I make a mistake, I don't have the right to make a mistake. I'm not saying this is the only reason. I'm saying there might be other reasons why people fail during class. You understand? There might be other reasons. A person has a desire to be successful, yet for certain reasons he fails. There could be other reasons. Let's say, for instance, person doesn't realize that he doesn't have the ability to keep up and he should be working at a slower pace. So therefore he might fail because of that. There are different reasons why a person fails. I'm just saying that based on the Ramban, I'm trying to explain, give an everyday example of how a person could fail for this reason that the Ramban is talking about. That's one possible reason. There could be other reasons. Okay? Yeah, in your particular case, you'll have to find a particular reason. Okay? But however, what I'm trying to bring out is that many times you have two views of life without realizing it. That's where you have contradictory opinions. You have two views of life without realizing it. One view is the view of that you know you're human and you should be able to make mistakes. The other one says, no, despite the fact that I'm human, I don't have the right to make mistakes. There's another one, like for instance, everybody, if you study Torah and you open Torah, you know God is not physical. And then they say that the soul of God comes from his cloak or is a part of God. The soul, the human being, comes from God, which means that God can be broken up into different parts, which means he holds that that God is physical, you see? So he holds consciously a one part of him. In the universal, he holds God is not physical. Then in the particular, you understand, he doesn't notice that he's actually making God physical by saying that my soul is made out of part of God. Well, if it's a part of God, that means God is divided among all our souls. So if God is divided, that means God is made up of parts. That's a physical quality, not a godly quality. So there are many cases where many times we have two different opinions and we don't notice it. The two different opinions many times come from our conscious view of life and our unconscious view of life, and many times we have to learn to recognize both, and that we sometimes live by the conscious view of life, sometimes by the unconscious view of life, and that's the first step in straightening it out, is to recognize the cases where I live two different views of life. I act as if there's two different worlds, okay? So therefore, in other words, there's some people that drive. They know they keep the law. Suddenly if they have friends in the car, suddenly they start driving crazy. You see? So the thing is that there's another part of them. They're in a situation where the unconscious takes over, and now they have a view of life that I can do anything, I will not be hurt, and the main important thing is to be great in front of my friends. And so therefore you deny the fact that anything could happen to you, even though as soon as they're not there, then you act according to the conscious part of your mind that you should drive correctly. So there are many cases or situations where you act correctly, then another situation you act incorrectly, which means there are two views that you're living by, and you have to know one of them is the conscious way, one of them is the unconscious way. Then the question is how to deal with it, okay? But the first step in dealing with it is yet you have to realize that you have two views of life coming from two different parts of you. One the conscious part of you, one the unconscious part of you. The question is when you are attacked, there are three ways of reacting to that attack. One is that I'm in terrible conflict, and as a result of that conflict, it causes me to be a coward. I have a fear of failure, that I won't be able to win against the person, so that makes me pull back. It has nothing to do with reality. In many cases, you would be able to win, but it's the self, the lack of confidence that you fail. I'd just like to clarify the question. The question is, if somebody attacks you, what could be your reaction to the attack? One is, I am in conflict and I have a bad self-image and I feel that I can't win, and as a result of that, I back off. Okay? Second is that the reality, I'm sorry, there are really four reactions. The reality to that side is if you objectively analyze the case and you really see that you will lose, then it's not worth fighting back. You understand? So the reaction.
Wrong, or because they're better fighters?
No, because they're better fighter, not because you're wrong. Okay? Right. So even if you're right, sometimes it's better to back off. Okay? And the second way is that I'm in conflict, and to cover the conflict, I attack back. In other words, this person, I don't care if they're right or wrong, it's a reaction. I'm not dealing with right or wrong, I'm dealing with the reaction of a person when somebody attacks them, or why people do attack. Many times they're in terrible conflict, and they don't want to deal with the conflict, and so that they don't have to deal with the conflict, they attack others. Okay? Lashon Hara is also that way. It's a means of that it's, except it's a quiet attack, but it is an attack. And then the thing is that where it's thought out, and you're really on the right, it's just, and it's the correct thing to protect yourself, so then you should attack. Okay? All right, so there are, when you are attacked, again, there are two irrational ways of approaching it, and two rational ways. The irrational way is I back off because of my emotions. The opposite of that is the rational way, is that I back off in a case, in reality, where I should back off. Okay? Second case is that I'm in conflict and I attack, whether I'm right or wrong, whether I could win or lose, I attack just so that I don't have to deal with the conflict. And the other way is that if I am right and it's practical, it's not vengeance, it's not my emotions, but it's a practical thing, then I am, then I should go out on the attack. In the second one, in other words, if you're a person in conflict, many times a person in conflict attacks others, like Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is a case where people are, it's an expression, Lashon Hara is an expression of different, of various conflicts. So therefore, it's the attack on others, and I don't have to involve, be involved in searching for my own weaknesses about this conflict. And go back to what the conflict is and analyze the conflict. The question is, let's say, for instance, there's a person in conflict and there is a real situation where the situation demands that you should protect yourself, but he uses it as a means for an outlet of his conflict. Question is, what would be the result of that? Right. I'd just like to clarify. Let's say, for instance, there somebody attacks me, and the only response to protect myself is to attack back. Let's say I know he'll. Let's say he attacks me now, he beats me up, and I know that if I don't put him in his place, he will attack me again. Okay. So therefore, the response is that I must do something about it. Okay. But when I do something about it, the motive that drives me is not the practicality. It's not that I thought through the practicality, but the fact that I'm in terrible conflict, you see. Now the question is, how does that work with that type of person? All right. Somebody attacks me, right? Somebody attacks me, okay? And practically I should attack back. But I don't think it through practically to do it, but I attack back as a result of vengeance. In other words, I react to him, and the conflict of vengeance of getting even makes me attack back. But it is not the practicality that causes me to attack back. So the question is, what is that type of person? And the question is what does that have on the psyche of the person that's taking vengeance? Okay? The question is there any time that you should take vengeance? And also, what is the practical situation that you have the right to attack a person? The answer is if a person harms you, and if you don't react, first of all, in that situation, if you could protect yourself, practically you have the right to protect yourself in that situation. But also, let's say the guy would do it once and you would never see him again. Practically, there is no benefit in hurting him. Then it's a matter of justice. It's not your problem. Justice is part of society, not the individual. Okay? In other words, if I get back at him, that is never justice. Justice is a societal thing. But I do have the right to protect myself. We don't hope from turning the other cheek. I do have the right to protect myself. Now, let's say somebody would attack me and I'll never see the guy again. Then I should report it to the government, let the government take care of it. It's not my business anymore. If I get involved, that's vengeance. But however, if I know the guy is going to attack me again, and I know it's a situation where the authorities of the government cannot protect me, then I have the right to do things to protect myself and to be on the offensive, because I know I have to stop him, but I have the right to protect myself, and so I can not really preempting since he started, okay? But the fact is that I have the right to protect myself. That is not, that would not be vengeance. That is the situation. There's no vengeance in and of itself. There's never permitted to do vengeance. Alright, so the question is, what about the Ari Mikla, the city of refuge? So the answer is that the terminology might be used as vengeance. Like sometimes the Torah talks about God taking vengeance. God does not take vengeance, but it's a metaphor. The whole Ore Miklat, if you look up the halacha, is based on halacha of when and how. It has to be thought out. It's not an emotion of that I do it whenever I feel like. It must be carried out based on halacha, and that is a system of justice. But they might, in the Torah, they might use the term vengeance, but it is not vengeance. The question is let's say the person that attacks me, and then I will never see him again. So, but he will attack other people in society, so shouldn't I do something about it? Yes, I should do something about it, but through the system of justice. I am not a policeman. I have the right to protect myself, you see, but I'm not a policeman for the society. I should report it to the authorities. If I have to be a witness, I should be a witness for the authorities. But however, I should not take the law into my own hands. But I do have the right to protect myself. The answer is that a person that does that, well, practically he is right. But however, since he is giving vent, and the framework is vengeance, he will definitely harm himself and do more damage to himself in the long run than going out to protect himself. So, I mean, not all the time. Sometimes your life is in danger, so then protection has to come first. But the fact is that the person that's doing it totally for vengeance, then that person will be harmed. Because since he has an outlet for that emotion, So the emotion grows, even though it's a correct situation, and as the emotion grows, so it becomes worse, the conflict becomes worse. However, it is possible that I'm aware of my, if I am aware of my emotion of vengeance, and I recognize that this is a practical situation, and I should do something about it, but I recognize my emotion of vengeance, as long as I keep it in check with the mind, then I think that it is possible to do it without being harmed. You understand? If you're aware of your own emotion, that you do have an emotion of vengeance, but you're aware of it, and then you deal practically and aware and deal and recognize the emotion and deal with it, even if you don't undo it, so you can't always undo an emotion, but the recognition of the emotion is the protection of you doing the act correctly and thinking it through and not going to extremes because of the emotion that could drive you on, and it will not lift higher the emotion of vengeance, because it's protected by the world of ideas. The reality holds it in check, holds the emotion in check. Okay. The reason why I brought this conversation is because there was just the bombing of the Trade Center and the World Trade Center, and they're talking about going out to get the people that did it. Now, conflict is not only on an individual level, conflict is on a national level too. And there's a tremendous amount of anger from what I hear on the news. So the thing is that even though this is a situation where if we don't do anything about it, it's definitely these people will come back and harm us more. You see, they will take it as a sign of weakness. They won't take it as a sign of niceness. But however, the motive that the United States is definitely, you see it and hear it, the anger is definitely a feeling of vengeance. That is a dangerous emotion if left unchecked. In other words, if we go out and recognize that we have the emotion of vengeance, but it should be worked out and clearly understood that it's only practical while we're doing it, then we could be successful. But it's not, if it's a matter of vengeance, first of all, the vengeance will make us carry the act beyond which reality demands, and the level of vengeance will be very high, and that's once it's raised, that level is raised to a higher level. Then the only way to undo that, to lower that, is through ideas, like we study here. This is not a simple way. Just can't stop doing it; it's going to go away. So therefore, I'm just saying that we have to be careful. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it, but we should be careful to make sure that when we do the act of attacking the people that did this, it should be not done through vengeance, but it should be done through reality, practicality. Well, the question is, what if I do an act, like in this case, I'm going to attack the people, but I do extra so that people should be afraid to attack me, okay? In other words, it's not for the people that I'm attacking, but I do it in such a way that other people will be afraid to attack me, okay? When Yeshua captured five of the kings, those days kings were also the generals, they led the war. So the thing is, he cut off the thumb of each one of the kings before he killed them, okay? And the Ralbach says, I believe it was the Ralbach that says that the reason why he did this was so that, first of all, the thumb represents where you pull back the bow to use a weapon, you need the thumb. So it shows that he weakened them, but it also showed other people to be frightened. And therefore, even if they do go to war, when a person goes to war with fear, like we said before, then the psychological part of you undermines your ability to fight. So therefore, Yeshua did this so not for vengeance, but for the future, so it should undermine the will of the people that's fighting him, which puts them in a bad situation. So you see that you can't, if it's worked out with Chachma, then you can do it. And you have to know, be very, very careful to know when it's with Chachma, when it's with vengeance. Vengeance, you're harming yourself, and it's wrong. But if it's worked out with Chachma, that it's for your protection, for your benefit, then you're allowed to do it. We see now, at this moment in the United States, that there is a tremendous amount of anger. You have road rage, you have people waiting online, people drive-by shootings. All these things show a tremendous amount of anger. Now what's going to happen is that if we attack this inner conflict that we have, this inner anger, so if we attack outside, attack the enemy, okay, we will have an outlet for the moment. We will have an outlet for our inner rage, which would, to a certain extent, protect us, because the rage will be outside towards the enemy, not within the country itself. But however, in the long run, what's going to happen is that the anger, if you do it for vengeance, so then the anger will be to a higher level than it was before, and when the war is over, all that anger must spill over within ourselves, within the own country, and do a tremendous amount of damage. So either they'll do a tremendous amount of damage so that the anger doesn't turn inwards to the citizens of the United States. So therefore, if you do not deal with the problem itself, then it will become, it could only become worse. The question is there a positive outlet? I say it like this. The first thing is you must recognize that you have the problem. Now, the first step is that you must recognize that you have the problem. Then there are outlets, for instance, exercise, punching bags, throwing darts. You know what I mean? There are physical outlets to... there are physical outlets to the anger that you have. There are ways of getting it out in a rational way. In other words, you must recognize that I have the anger, or I have the desire for vengeance. Then you can have physical outlets for it, but not in an unjust way against another person. Now, if you recognize this, that can protect you from going too far in your vengeance, and it will protect you from raising that desire for vengeance to a higher level. You could, because you recognize what it is, so it's in control. There is a Gemara that says that a father had a son that had a lot of anger, so he gave him glass to throw and break. Okay, and that was that's a good outlet. That's what we're saying. It's a good outlet. It's a good outlet for anger. But however, let's say, for instance, in modern times we have toy guns. The question is since I am pointing it at a particular person, you see, is that in my fantasy, does that raise the level of anger and vengeance in me? Or no, since I know it's a fake, so then there is no... then that would also be a good outlet. We'll leave the listener of this tape to find the answer to this question. Thank you. And the question is that since emotions are that which causes harm, and we're not permitted, and we should not make decisions based on emotions but on ideas, so the question is, why is kindness or chesed, why is that I should take in consideration the emotions of other people and myself? In the Psalms, in Tillim, it's
It's chapter 145, Psalm Kuf Mem He. It says that God relates to people in the four ways: Hanun v'racham Hashem, Erech Apayim, u'Gadol Chasad. We're interested in the last one when it says Gadol Chasad. Gadol Chasad means that, what do you mean great kindness? What is great kindness? It means that there's something in the human being that other animals don't have, and that is emotions. In other words, another animal does not need a lazy boy, you know, to relax him. You know what I mean? He doesn't need a soft bed. He just operates based on instinct, and the instincts are based on the survival of the species. Okay, but however, the emotions, I feel like having a comfortable couch. I mean, that is, I could survive without the couch, but it satisfies me emotionally, or even let's say, for instance, a person wants a candy. You understand? I mean, like he has a piece of candy, as long as, you know, it's not harmful to him. And so the thing is, it just satisfies the emotions. It's not going to protect them or the survival of the species. And yet we see God takes consideration of that part of us, that he takes consideration so that that to make sure that we could satisfy that part of us. In other words, what we see from here, that God created the human being that he has emotions. Okay, once he created a being that has emotions, then it is necessary, desires, whatever the source of the desire, he has the right to satisfy that desire. In other words, a human being has the right to satisfy all aspects which God created. You see? So therefore, since God created emotions, so therefore I have the right to satisfy it, except, of course, where it's against halacha, like I have a desire to go against halacha, or I have a desire to do something that's harmful. But otherwise, any emotion that that I desire, there's no reason why I should not satisfy it if it doesn't fall into one of those two categories. Since God created me that way, to have those desires, so therefore I have the right to satisfy them, and therefore it would be kindness where I can to help others to satisfy their emotional needs. The question is that there's theories in the psychology today about that everything comes from the physical. Some people hold that everything comes from the psychological. Seems to be that it works on both. There is the physical part, means comes from the genes. That today they seem to be able to deal with chemicals. If a person is extremely like psychotic, they could help them to not become psychotic, or of depression, they could help. It seems to help. Okay, but the thing is that we also hold from the psychological, and in the psychological, that is the area where the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, is. That is the evil inclination, when you make decisions based on your psychological or emotional makeup. And therefore, if you read the Rishonim, the earlier commentaries, you will find that they understood and knew a tremendous amount of psychology. They talk about dreams, they talk about projection, they talk about that the unconscious, or they call it the Yetzirah, psychotic. Okay? So the thing is that they had the whole, they definitely had Freudian psychology, the Rishonim. There's only two things that I never saw. I don't know if they didn't have it, but there's two things that I never saw them write about. I haven't seen them write about his sex theories or free association. But Freud. But otherwise, the ideas that he comes up with, the Rishonim had. Because, and they had to talk about it, because that is the area of the Yetzer Hara. Okay? And because of that, I mean, you could learn psychology just from the modern psychology. You could learn from the Rishonim because they have to understand the nature of the Eitz Hara to deal with it. Okay, a woman asked me, what is the Jewish attitude towards what happened last week of the destruction of the Twin Towers? So I'd like to try to answer that question. First thing is that Rabbeinu Yonah writes a commentary on Chumash. And on this week's portion, which happens to be Nitzavim, he quotes a verse from Proverbs. And he says like this, "The Musar of God, my son, don't despise, and it should not weary you." His admonition should not weary you. "Because he who God loves, he admonishes, like a father who's close or desires the best for his son." That's the verse.
What's the number, Rabbi?
Oh, it's Proverbs 3, verse 11 and 12.
Thank you.
Okay? Now I'm going to translate the Rabbeinu Yonah, his explanation first. Okay? He says all the commandments in the Torah are called Musar. Okay? And then he defines Musar. He says Musar comes from the verse in Psalms 34, chapter 34, verse 14. It says, "Turn away from evil and do good." The word sur means turn away, and so Musar comes from that. So he says, Musar is to turn away from evil. That's the term Musar.
Was that Psalm?
Okay. So he says, all the negative mitzvahs, all the negative commandments, he says, is for the person, to help the person turn away from evil. And this evil, we say, is divided into three types. Okay? One type is that there are things that are evil inherently in itself, like murder or stealing. And therefore we have a negative commandment that you should not steal, not murder. There are some that are evil from the point of view because it heightens the desires, the physical desires. Like we have the prohibitions of food, which is to prevent gluttony, and we have prohibitions of the sexual prohibitions. So the thing is, this is all to prevent the attachment to the physical pleasures. And there are evil from the point of view that they're legislated by God that you should not do. They're evil because God said you should not do it. Like, for instance, shatness. Shatness is you cannot have woolen linen interwoven in one garment. Now, there is nothing inherently wrong with it, and it will not. And if you do have woolen linen woven together, it will not lead to any great desires in the physical world. So it's only prohibited because God said, God wanted it to be prohibited. So it's evil because God said you shouldn't do it. He says, similarly is the positive commandments that we are commanded. So there are also three categories. One is good because of itself, the act itself, like we are obligated to have courts. So courts are good, benefit for society. Or they are good because they help man acquire correct knowledge, like the study of Torah, or the command that on Pesach night we're obligated to tell over the story of the Exodus. Or there are commandments that are that it's only by legislation that it's that because God told us, so therefore it's a commandment. Right, circumcision and tefillin. All right, there's no somebody mentioned the lulav. All those are only beneficial only because God legislated. Now he explains how all of these categories help you remove evil. He says the first two negative commandments, namely where inherently it's evil, or it leads to higher attachment to the physical world, that you could understand that it removes, helps you distance you from evil. Says the positive commandments, he says, if a man is involved in good acts and he acquires correct knowledge, these two things will make evil despicable to him. In other words, when he understands how harmful evil is, then he will turn from it. He'll turn away. And he says, and insofar as we keep the chukim, the laws which are only there because God commanded, he says, that means that that helps us recognize that we're just doing it for God, and we are his slave or a servant, and therefore it helps us because we relate to God. And in other words, we do these commandments only because God told us, so that helps us relate to God, and because we relate to God, we distance ourselves from evil. That is the statement of the Rabbeinu Yonah. Just to review the original verse of the of Mishlei. So he says, Musa Hashem, in other words, where God does something to help us turn to, in other words, the Musa of Hashem is all the commandments in the Torah, as we now see. He says, don't despise it. Despise it means that I won't do it. I won't be involved in it. I won't be involved in the commandments because it's too much of a pain. The second is don't be wary of it. In other words, sometimes it just becomes a burden on us to do it. After a while, I force myself, but I don't want to do the mitzvahs, but I force myself. He says, because he who God loves, he admonishes. Just like, in other words, there's a real benefit, and if you see the benefit in it, then you will be happy. I mean, then you will be happy with all the commandments, because you see the benefit, so you'll be happy with all the commandments. Okay, so David wants to add like this. He says, the chukim, the benefit of the chukim, the laws that are legislated by God, is it gives you a different perspective than the other categories. Because here, you do not, in the act itself, you only do it because God said so, and you do not see any benefit. So it gives you the perspective of that I must accept the idea of a God, which is more objective than where I could see a precise benefit in the action, where I could tell you what the benefit is. That could still be self-centered. But here I'm doing it only because I relate to God. The question is why does, if we're talking about the mitzvahs, the commandments, and why does King Solomon use the word Musa when he's talking about the commandments? The idea is that, according to Rabbeinu Yonah, he wants to get across, King Solomon, by using the word Musa for the mitzvos, is to tell you that the purpose of the mitzvos is that you should turn away from evil. That's why he used the term Musa, to tell you the motive, the purpose of all the mitzvos is to help you to turn away from evil. Now, when there is a study in the Torah called Musar, the whole study of Musar is to turn away from evil. Okay? Like we just heard the term. But the study itself deals with making decisions in everyday life, how to make decisions in everyday life, and about God. And also, when you cannot make a correct decision, how to undo the yetzirah, the evil inclination, or the emotions that cause you to do this incorrect act, how to deal with that part of you. That's the study of Musa, which now follows very clearly its connection, the whole idea of Musa, its connection to the mitzvos, because if all the commandments is whole purpose is to remove evil. That's the whole purpose. And then, so therefore, now there's a follow-up in other areas of life that I could do incorrect acts. So there's a follow-up in all areas of life that I should investigate the ideas of good and evil, and to make sure I remove these ideas. In other words, the mitzvahs are help you get started and give you the guidance, and then you must carry it through in all other areas of life through the study of Musar to the remove evil from all aspects of your life. Okay, when this catastrophe of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, when it collapsed, there came, as soon as people could calm down, they were able to think, there are many, many questions that people have about what's going on. There's many questions. A few examples are, for instance, there was a person on one of the hijacked planes that called his wife, and he told his wife that they're going to take over, they're going to try to take over the hijackers. And she said to him, don't make yourself visible, you know, try not to do anything, you know, to awaken their anger. So there's two different views here of what to do in this situation. Who's right? You must stop and think. Is this a situation for courage, or is this a situation to back off? You can't say you should always be courageous. You can't say you should always back off. So you have to analyze that. You have to know this, if you have the ability to do what is right. If you find out that he was right, you have the ability to do that. The question is now, we want to go to war. Okay? Well, first you have to analyze, is it a just war, or is it just vengeance? If it's vengeance, it's evil. If it's a just war, then you should do it. The question is, let's say, for instance, we're going to a just war, but we're all doing it because of vengeance, even though it's a just war. How do you ask? The question is, how could it be a just war and we're still doing it because of vengeance? In other words, let's say in this situation, okay, let's say we analyze it and we come to the conclusion that it's just, that we should go out and attack these terrorists wherever they are. Okay? Alright? But let's say, for instance, the people in the United States is not thinking rationally. They just want to go out and do it. Their desire is just to get back, to hurt these people. They don't think about their emotions or their personality. Now, so therefore, they're going to do it for vengeance, even though it might be a just war. Now, what will happen to the United States, and what are the consequences of such a situation? Okay? Somebody asked me a question. There's a whole amount today. I mean, there hasn't been this type of patriotism probably since Pearl Harbor. It's practically similar. Everybody's making comparisons. I mean, what is patriotism? What is that emotion? Is that good or is it bad? You see? Plus, there's many questions about God. All of a sudden, questions about God come in. Do these people deserve to die? The people that came late, that didn't get killed, do they deserve to live? You understand? I mean, all these type of questions come up. Besides the questions, there's different emotions. Our own emotions that we have to watch. There's anger, there's vengeance. You see? All these things have to be thought through. You see? Our own emotions. I think this is even though this is extremely difficult, because everybody is very highly charged in this situation, I think that a person, and you see in this week's portion, in the Tzavim, Moses is speaking to the nation and telling them all the consequences of what will happen to them if they do not keep the Torah. You see, that is, and you see, according to Rabbeinu Yonah, the whole purpose of Torah is to remove evil. So every situation that awakens different questions about life, or how to act, or awakens certain emotions that you start seeing that you desire to do certain things, emotionally, it must be checked out. Those desires, are they in line with justice? Or are they in line with something else? Are they Is it correct or is it evil? Should I turn away from it or should I be attached to it? Or every catastrophe situation should be used as a situation to be able to investigate and to develop yourself to constantly remove yourself from evil. It is the catastrophic situations that really bring out emotions that you didn't even know you had. And sometimes people could be very nice, comes a certain situation, suddenly anger comes out, 1 minute. So I do have anger, and it has to be dealt with. I didn't know I have it, but now I know I have it, I have to deal with it. So all these things must be analyzed, and they're all brought forth in a catastrophic situation, so therefore those are the best situations to deal with the knowledge of the evil inclination, and in particular your own personal inclinations, which way they turn, whether they turn towards good or evil. You have to be careful. The attitude is not to have an outpouring of your emotions. Sometimes you can't help yourself, but if you do, then at least afterwards, when you calm down, to stop and think about it. But you must use every situation that you're in to try to remove evil from within yourself, because we see that is the purpose of the whole Torah. In other words, if somebody has an outpouring of emotions at that moment, we are not saying that outpouring is right or wrong. All we're saying, at some point, it should be analyzed whether it was the right or wrong. At some point. So if it's wrong, then I should deal with it. If it's the right, then I should be content with and satisfied with the state that I'm in. All right. In other words, when a person is involved in the situation, you have to act. You have to do things like the firemen. They went out immediately, and the people called in or gave blood. There was no time to really think. It was only to do and to help and to get involved. But then afterwards, when you have time, then there should be investigation. Did I did the right thing, or did I did an incorrect thing? If I did the right thing, did I did to the most of that I could? Or I just, did it very nicely, but I didn't go to what I should have done. So all these things have to be analyzed, and if I'm short in what the good thing is, or if I did something bad, then I have to uproot it and undo it. That is what I think is the Torah attitude towards all these type of situations that bring out your emotions, and to recognize that, to see it in yourself. And even when you're doing the right act, so then you should make sure that you did it for the correct motive. Sometimes you could do the right act for the incorrect motive, which is a good thing. It's a good thing. But however, you should try and straighten out the motive and make the motive for the correct motive. That's correct. The particular question that we'd like to deal with today is the question, why this happened to the United States? That's basically the question. Why this happened to the United States and what caused it? Okay? There are a lot of people that are saying, of course, that because the United States is for Israel, and therefore, they hate Israel. They hate not only Israel; they hate Jews by their very religion. So therefore, they just have to take away to harm the United States, so as to that they could get to harm Israel. Okay. That's one of the reasons people give. When Bin Laden first came to notice, a couple of years ago, there was an article that I read that, and I think it's known that Bin Laden was working for the CIA, and I don't know if it was in Afghanistan or was someplace. I think it was in Afghanistan. To help them fight the Russians, because we were against the Russians. And at that point, there was a change in the American policy, and they in the United States stopped helping him. Okay. Now, it is possible, in other words, if you're dependent on somebody and suddenly that person pulls away, you don't think of that the guy helped me, you think only of that the guy pulled away. There's a terrible hatred. You see, Bin Laden seems to be, from all his acts, going after the United States, you see. Other Muslims seem to think that is good because it's going to weaken Israel. But Bin Laden himself seems to be totally directed towards the United States. So therefore, it makes me think that this is the reason why he's out for the United States. Okay? I understand the other possibility, and I don't doubt that he has that in mind. You understand? I don't doubt that, but I think there's a personal thing on his side of his hatred towards the United States. And so therefore, with our principle that we have to see and learn from everything, so the thing is that sometimes we don't notice, and because of our haughtiness, we just do things for ourselves and we make enemies without realizing it. And we think that we're above, no enemy could touch us, you see. Once you receive that type of haughtiness and you create enemies, you're going to meet the enemy that's going to bring you down, you understand? Or he's going to spend his life, especially if you find an enemy that devotes his life to bringing you down, that guy will probably be, if he's not successful, he'll do a lot of damage. So it could be that, if that is the reason, then I think that we have to learn is how to make sure, to the best of our ability, sometimes we don't even notice it, how not to make enemies. Because every enemy is dangerous. If you have a quantity of enemies, it becomes extremely dangerous. Because together, sometimes they could join together, or if one really puts all his energy into it, he will either bring you down or do you damage. The question is does God have anything to do with this? I don't think so. In other words, like this. Whenever I think of God getting involved, I must have some type of proof from the Torah that God gets involved in this type of situation. Now, we know the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, why it was destroyed, because God sent his prophets and told them what sins they are doing. There are many sins, many times where God destroyed things in the Torah, like Sodom or by the flood. So the commentaries give the reason of what caused it. They see from the verses and they interpret the verses and shows what caused it. But without a prophet to guide me, then the most I could do is give high probability. But even then, the probability must be based on my knowledge of God when God intervenes and how he intervenes. Based on that, I must say, when and where God intervenes. Does God deal in this type of situation? It doesn't seem to be so. Okay? Right. The Radak on... the question is they would like to have a proof why I think it's not so. They would like a proof why... in other words, have the Ashkacha... why I think it's not here. There's a Radak on Yonah, the story of Yonah, and the Radak says like this. He says that God's Hashkacha, God's personal supervision on the nations, are different than his supervision on Israel. On Israel, we're responsible if we don't keep the commandments. Okay. The other nations are responsible if they don't reach a level of total evil. In other words, where they reach such an evil where They only harm just for harm's sake, for nothing else. You see? In other words, what he says is where it's a total breakdown of a civilization. You see? So the thing is the attack on the United States, I don't think the United States is so evil. I mean, you know, on the contrary. The United States has been very good to, especially to the Jews, have been very good to the Jews. We're really free. It's like an island in thousands of years. Well, one of the few islands that the Jew has a certain amount of freedom. And I don't see the evil that it reached that level. I don't say they don't do evil things, but the thing is that it's not that level of evil. And so therefore, I don't think that it was an act of God. The question is that when this happened to the United States, is definitely going to affect the Jews, and also definitely affect the Muslims who are evil. I don't know if they've reached that level of evil. I can't define the level of evil that the Radak is talking about. But the thing is that the I have not seen, in other words, where God destroys another nation. I don't know in Torah. Where God destroys another nation so as to harm Israel. Whenever he harmed Israel, he harms them directly. I don't see...
What about the benefit?
Okay, the question is what about the benefit to Israel? Because the United States is going to go after terrorists and people won't be able to condemn Israel for that. Right, so I don't know. I don't have a proof either way. At this point, I don't have a proof either way then. I mean, you'll have to bring me proof from Torah someplace. But God works this way, then there could be a possibility. Practically speaking, I have to operate in my everyday life. I mean, based on the laws of nature, was what I see. You understand? I can't make a decision on what God's plan is. You understand? So if it comes out that after a while there comes information that it was God's plan, and we will find proofs for it from verses and psukim, then fine. But at this point, I don't have any, and so therefore, I can't assume that it is, and so therefore, I must accept that it was just simply the laws of nature. I can't say anything else. The question is that didn't the Muslims reach a level where they kill men, women, and children? They don't care for life. Haven't they reached the level where where God should intervene? First of all, I don't know. I don't know how to measure how low you have to go before God intervenes. And secondly, if God would intervene with the Muslims, they would be dead. I mean, so far I don't see anything done to the Muslims. So I don't see anything. I mean, just because you're telling me that the United States will, first of all, what the United States will do, I don't know if they will do it. Secondly, if they will do it, I don't know if they'll be successful. So the thing is, you're telling me suppositions that we have no idea. And yet you're assuming that since it's all good, so therefore must be God is intervening. I don't know. I don't know if God is intervening. I don't know at this point. I don't see anything to make me think that God is intervening at this point in the situation. I just want to say that you can, if you go back to the Torah, and you do see ideas that and then you interpret a particular situation that it fits into that idea of Torah that God is intervening, then all you could have is a certain probability. You can never have certainty. The only way you can have certainty in these type of areas is if God tells you through prophecy, or he tells one of our prophets, then you could have certainty. But if God doesn't tell you, then you cannot have certainty. You can only have probability. Okay, one of the examples that they want to give from Torah is that God made a famine in Egypt so as to force Jacob to be brought down to Egypt via Yosef. So you see that God affects a country to bring in line his plan, to get his plan that he wanted to create a nation in slavery for whatever reason, but that was part of his plan. So you see that God could affect another nation to benefit, to get his plan working. So, okay, but I have no reason to believe at this point. In other words, only when I look at historically backwards, maybe I could give a probability. But at this point, I have no information that it, I don't see any of the repercussions, whether good or bad yet. Just because it sounds good doesn't mean it is good. I have to see when it happens. It could be bad. It could be come out bad. It could come out very... we don't know. So the thing is that... or I just don't know. I just don't know. It says in chapter 4 of the book of Esther, chapter 4, at the end of verse 14, when Mordechai is speaking to Esther, so he tells her, he says, "And who knows if it's a time like this that you have reached to royalty?" In other words, he's saying, at that time, he says, according to my knowledge of the of Hashgacha, of God's personal supervision, God could have placed you there for this purpose. But he says, who knows? It is possible. But I'm not 100% sure. You see? So Mordechai uses probability. Okay? And he's, you understand, so even Mordechai, who seems to have prophecy, a certain level of prophecy, but he seems to, he only says it's probable based on his knowledge. And the question is that it says that God's admonition is in the verse, in our verse, says God's admonition. So we want to know if this is God's admonition. Now, the answer is like this. There are two ways that God relates to us. One is through the laws of nature, and one, he gets involved and affects the laws of nature to affect us. But when he created the laws of nature, basically the laws of nature should work out for the human being very well, and he should have a good life. But however, the emotions of the human being look at life very incorrectly, and therefore even the perfect life, he sees things incorrect. And two, because he sees things incorrectly, he does incorrect acts, and he causes harm to himself. You see? So therefore, even in the laws of nature, you are admonished, in other words, when you do wrong. And therefore, you must analyze even things that happen in the laws of nature, okay, what you could learn from that situation. That's also part of the Musa Hashem, of the rebuke of admonishment of God.